The fact that a minor change in the lens makes a change in the impedance tells you immediately something funny is happening. The majority of the energy spent trundles down that wire of the antenna the first time, hits the end of the wire, 90% of it is still there, and it reflects back. And when it reflects back, depending on the length of the wire, it either comes back in phase or out of phase. If the length of the wire is just right, it comes back in phase and gets re-reflected forward. And so there's going to be something like 20 bounces of that radio energy on the antenna, and your definition of resonance is to keep all those bounces in step with each other. You make that antenna a hell of a lot shorter. It now has less real estate out in the air radiating the signal. A smaller percentage of it gets radiated on the first pass. A higher percentage hits the ends and reflects back. Now instead of it being 20 bounces, it's going to be 40 or 50 bounces. That's the nature of why a shorter antenna re-resonated has a higher Q or a narrower bandwidth. There's a larger number of bounces before the signal finally gets radiated. You radiate the signal by bouncing it a whole lot of times and keeping the bounces in step and creating enough real estate for it to radiate. The number of inches of wire in the air with the signal flowing on it is where the radiation...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's where the radiation is coming from one point of view. And there's an awful lot of real evidence you can gather in your backyard that'll support that point of view. You try to use Maxwell's equations to come up with that conclusion, and there's a lot of steps in between. You ain't going to get it. But you talk to the people who are really building antennas, the real rules of thumb that they use, the real experience that they've got, the things that have worked and have not worked, fall into the categories of what I've just told you as empirical evidence, as heuristic evidence, as experience. Call it what you like. You resonate first, and hopefully you've got enough real estate out there to do the radiating. If not, you're going to live with a very narrow Q. You can make the antenna infinitesimal in length. It's going to be narrow band as all hell, but if you're smart enough, you can still radiate nearly 100% of that power with almost the same pattern. The pattern of the antenna doesn't really change until the antenna gets multiple half wavelengths in physical size. Now you've got the interferometry capability of really generating directivity. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Very nice explanation, Dick. Thanks again. But I would want to add one more thing to it. You explained very, very nicely what happens, of course, when the antenna is shortened and what happens to the bandwidth of the antenna. There is a reduction in bandwidth. But could you share a couple of words with us about what happens when we're at, let's say, a half-point wavelength antenna, and we make it longer? So now the antenna is really a longer antenna than we would normally use on that band, but now we retune it and rematch it back to 50 ohms. What generally happens to the bandwidth there, Dick? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
If I start off with a half-wave dipole that is electronically half-wave, and I start making it longer, I start moving it to 5/8 wave, 3/4 wave, and so on, the Brownian-Woodward curve will tell you immediately the antenna is going to be inductive. Inductive really means you still have energy bouncing back and forth. The energy now bounces back from the tip of the antenna at the first bounce, on the first travel down the wire. It hits the open end at the far end and comes back. Because the wire is longer, it comes back late. Late, we call that lagging in phase. Lagging in phase, we call that inductive. These words all come together. It's an inductive antenna. Now, by putting a series capacitor at the base of the antenna, I can get rid of the inductive reactive components and get back to resonance. Now, what is that capacitor doing? Is that capacitor speeding up the signal in that area so that it now can bounce back and forth in phase? The mechanism by which adding a series capacitor makes all the bounces now fall back in step with each other, even though each bounce is going through a longer piece of wire and going through a delay. What's really happening there? One way of looking at it is that if the original dipole was half wavelength long, the bounces are in step. If it's one wavelength long, the bounces are in step. When you add that capacitor at the base of the antenna that's just a little bit too long, are you now jumping up to the point where you're re-resonating it at the one wavelength point, or have you somehow speeded up the signal so you're back electronically to the half wavelength point? I'm not sure which is going on. I do know that all the bounces fall back in step, even though the wire is too long. I'm at a bit of a conundrum to try to explain that. How do all the bounces go back in step with each other, even though there's got to be an extra delay because of the extra length of wire? I wonder if you got a guess as to what's going on.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I wonder if you got a guess as to what's going on that one, Glenn. To add the inductor on the base of the antenna when it's too short, to bring it back into resonance where the inductor is a delay line, no problem. I see how that works. But when the antenna is a little bit too long, and I add a capacitor, and now all the bounces fall back in step, how did I cancel the extra length that created too much delay on each one of those bounces? How does the capacitor do that? How does the capacitor create a leading phase angle? I know darn well the signal is not going through the capacitor at faster than the speed of light, yet electronically it acts as if I had done that. Give me a guess as to what's going on, Glenn. Put on your real sharp magnifying glasses and look down at the molecular level. What the hell is happening? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I would suspect is that if I had a network analyzer where I could actually view beyond 360 degrees, in other words, if I could look at let's say, insertion phase and beyond one wavelength, and I could look at, you know, say, beyond 360 degrees, 720, and then multiples thereof after, by adding the capacitor, what I would suspect is happening is that we're actually not... we're not leading the signal in that area. What we're actually doing is we're adding an extra phase length so that we're actually catching it in the next cycle. So what's actually happening is instead of maybe picking it up at before the 360 degrees, it's somewhere after the 360 degrees at which we reach resonance again, because now we have a multiple of 360 degrees at which we can cancel the reactive component that's beyond one wavelength. And then we go find up with another match there. And I would imagine that also the bandwidth is probably a little bit limited as opposed to where it would be in, let's say, at the quarter wave, half wave marks. But there again, I would expect that as you go to another frequency, you may not get an exact 50 ohm match, but it'll probably be feasible swing back up again, and then might find another point where it might drop down again. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Wes, recognize your original question was, does the bandwidth increase or decrease when you go beyond half wave? Right now, I don't know. I do know that you and I can buy a mag mount antenna that's a 5/8 wave vertical mag mount for the car. And because it is feeding the end of an antenna that's longer than a half wave, at exactly a half wave, you'd be feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance. Longer than half wave, it's still a very high impedance. If you look at what's in the base of that magnetic structure on the bottom of a 5/8 wave ground plane, you'll find a coil of wire going to ground, so that there is a loading coil in series with the antenna, and it's sometimes a capacitor also, and your input coaxial cable is tapped on one of the turns of that loading coil. The loading coil, by the way, is quite often a printed circuit helical thing, a printed circuit, what do you call it now? A planar helix, if you know what I mean. A planar spiral. It's a spiral, printed circuit spiral is what it really is. So, from one point of view, the 5/8 wave with that loading coil at the bottom has been brought up to 3/4 wave, and 3/4 wave is, by the way, resonant again as a monopole. So, it looks like electronically you're taking this antenna beyond half wave, bringing it up to 3/4 wave resonance, and then feeding that particular impedance by a tap-up structure. And does a 5/8 wave have more or less bandwidth than a half wave or a quarter wave? Right now, I don't know. Wes, you got an opinion on this? K2LIW?
No, I have material on the questions, but I was wondering, would we have a time for it?
Hey, Dick, we might have to put this one on the side and come back to it later. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, this is one that's not going to be easily settled. Wes, I've seen some of those nice movies of TK and whatever, and the three references you gave us in the most recent email, and good-looking stuff. And one of those tests, which, by the way, the date on the test looked like it was done in 2007, he's got this huge piece of hardware in a great big Electromagnetic Interference Testing Laboratory, a very expensive looking laboratory, where they're looking.
2008 in Turkey. They invested hundreds of thousands of dollars into that, and were trying to find out if decay technology works and how it works. There was a presentation of 100 kilowatts of power driven from one single impulse, no battery, and no other power supply involved.
Yeah, so that was in Turkey. That was a beautiful-looking laboratory with this very wide
helical antenna that was there. Actually, it wasn't a helical antenna. It was a vertically placed antenna.
Log periodic.
That's what I'm trying to say, but I keep getting interrupted. An extremely beautiful, very broadband log, vertically polarized log periodic. So in other words, the electromagnetic interference that the spark gaps were creating was apparently being measured. We could see 2 meters at one end of the room, which I presume represented input power, and we saw the 240 volts at zero current. Another set of meters at another end of the room, we saw 240 volts at a significant current, which I presume was flowing into the light bulbs. I presume that was the output power. Is that approximately what we were seeing, Wes? Go ahead.
That is correct, with one addition. Part of that room where the device was lying on the glass table with the glass legs on it, the walls were made with a metal sheet. I assume it was a copper. And the ceiling was as well. But then you had a dividing pattern, which was on the right-hand side next to the periodic antenna. In front of that antenna on the right-hand side, there was a sort of temporary wall with very fine screen made of copper. And then there was a something like in that opening, approximately 3 feet high, right in front of the floor, screen again, and then the screen on the top, on the ceiling, placed at 90 degrees to the ceiling, creating some kind of not a square-like, but a opening that was only giving a certain pattern to the antenna.
I saw that step in the walls and the ceiling of the testing chamber, the room. I assume that was part of the design of the room. I presume that that was not part of TK's hardware or his requirement. Is that true?
That is true. The point was, Westall approached TK and asked him to make the experiment. And before that, you've seen the video of the president-elect and the member of parliament. He was doing the first one was actually a 20-something 500-watt light bulb. They look smaller because they were 220s in Europe. And the device that was on the table in his house was very small and was doing that. But coming back to Westall and Turkey. What they wanted to make sure is that they promised him 500 millions of euro for it. They never paid this money, but anyhow. They wanted to make sure what's going on, and they were filming everything, not allowing him to make one single movie. But at the end of that movie, you've seen a gentleman with a telephone. This guy is one of the major rulers from Westall. And end of the story was actually that, as far as I know, that in order for TK to sue Westall, he has to go to Austria and have a certain amount of money deposited in the bank in order to do it. So, you know, that's how they... But my suspicion is, I mean, it was never confirmed. They went with this technology to oil guys, and they make a deal for billions of dollars to keep it silent. So everything was made because of the requirement of Westall. They asked a number of engineers, a number of scientists to be there present. And till now, they didn't say that was a fake and to exist.
Because all of TK's hardware was rather open for visualization, and people were running around with cameras, by way of the cameras and whatever, nothing is hidden per se. In other words, a sufficiently enthusiastic person looking at those photographs, in theory, could duplicate that hardware if they wanted to. Therefore, that procedure of that demonstration, where nothing was behind a curtain, so to speak, was not keeping any of the technology secret. So therefore, was TK willing to allow it to become public in that manner? And has anyone else, by way of those movies, duplicated any of that hardware, to your knowledge? Over to you, Wes.
The hardest part is samozapitka. Samozapitka means self-powering. That means part of the all the access of energy to be returned to the sources and then used as the energy that was powering the system. Yes, it happened. There is a number of guys who made the progress, and after me being involved in that and visiting TK and talking to him, I've got his promise that is recorded that he's going to release it to the public. But he didn't do it as well. As of now, I know about at least three individuals who were able to do that, and my group as well, me, Aaron Athanaitis, I'm pretty much sure that we were able to reach our unity, although we were following mostly Donald Smith American experiments. And we were able to, that's what I say, 3 watts in and 100 watts out when I was in Lithuania. But before that, that was 600 watts out. And I was in here. We were just talking and having the experiments over the internet. The generators were driven through the computer from England and Turkey.
KC2QAQ with a question for Wesley on this one.
You got it, Glenn.
Wesley, I have a couple of questions for you about the language that they were speaking in the background. I actually had a friend of mine, she came over and was able to translate some of it, but I'm sure not all of it was Russian that she heard. Some of it she was able to translate for me. But I guess one of the best translations that I got, at least in that last video, was that... They were discussing a lot about a very, very strong concern, I guess, about interference. It was a word, I don't know if the translation I was getting, because the person I had doing the translation for me really wasn't very technical, but I was trying to get her to translate as best as she could. And it seemed to me as if they were very, very interested in the way I was, I guess, understanding that they had a lot of EMI concerns, and I guess... because right now there's probably a lot of strict regulations in the EU as far as electromotive interference. And I think that that seemed to be part of the concern that they had there. I don't know if you can verify some of that or whatever, Wesley, back to you. KC2QIQ.
Depends which material you're talking about. The one that was with the glass table, they were talking three languages, but most of that it was Turkish and Russian. Some of Georgian. The second movie, it was a Turkish, and mostly, and the reason for that was because they had a guest from Turkey, so they were talking in Turkish. Turkish is pretty much popular in that part of the world, so and Turkish.
But the question being, Wesley, did you also get the same impression that I was getting, at least from the translations that I was hearing, that they were very, very concerned about electromotive interference?
And the fact that that very large log periodic and electromagnetic interference equipment was standing by, aimed at it, says that they did want to make that measurement. And do I have reason to believe that that measurement alarmed them, or is just something that they said, well, we're going to have to learn to live with this? Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
What they wanted to do is collect the most of the data about the device, and eventually they wanted to possess all of the secrets of TK and find out what is the best spectral frequency that they can utilize. TK wasn't really using any sophisticated equipment. Now, no, it was not the major problem with the interference. The thing was, and I also put my spectrum analyzer on duty when I was doing my experiments. It didn't occupy the whole spectrum. The frequency of operation is approximately 20 kilohertz, but the higher it goes, the better the effects you have. So probably in around 60 kilohertz, there was one third of the interference. If you look at the spectral components on the screen, at approximately 5 kilohertz, you have a very little something that will create any questions. So the Faraday cage will be probably the best enclosure for such a device interaction.
Well, Wesley, you don't remember a part in that discussion that was going on there, that they were interested in a sweep between 30 to 1 gigahertz, 30 megahertz to 1 gigahertz, and that there was a very, very strong interference, and I think it was around 225 megahertz?
Oh, yes. But the thing is that you've been listening to the discussion between the scientists and the owners of the representatives of Westall. If you're talking about this one, or you're talking about the one on the in the house?
No, the one at the end where they were using the wide periodic antenna, and the group of individuals there were all discussing basically the measurements that they were taking from it and the spectrum of the noise. But it just seemed to me as if they were measuring noise on the output, and it was of concern to them. I'm going to pass back to K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I have a comment.
If they like the way the machine behaves, to have to put the machine inside of a Faraday shield to stop the radiation, the spark gaps from radiating signals to the outside world, that's doable. If the spark gap itself is where most of the radiation is coming from, to put it into the right kind of a chamber, that's doable. I don't think that's a showstopper. So to measure the interference is a nice academic thing to know, but I don't think that's a showstopper. The main question I have for you, Wes, and you might not have an immediate answer for it yet, is that you're in the process of reproducing hardware that is slightly like, or maybe an improvement of, what's being shown in some of those videos. Have you, from your point of view up till this point, received enough of the information of how the original circuit is configured and works, and therefore you believe you have on your diagrams of what you're building most of the essence of what is required, or are you somewhat in the process of gathering that essence? WX2, boy, my goodness, it must be getting late. N2XJN, K2RW.
The answer is yes. I first have seen this effect 1 year ago on my table. I wasn't really in contact with TK at that time, more than 1 year ago. And I announced that a few months later, and there was a big laugh from that 8 seconds, and the light bulb was simply burned up. I couldn't really repeat that experiment. I remember I spoke to Eric at that time, and Eric told me, listen, you cannot work this way. You cannot have a structure that is a bunch of wires that you don't know what's going on. If I didn't touch it, I would probably have this device done a long time ago. Then I spoke to you, Dick, and, got the impression, yeah. Now, maybe I didn't foresee something that was happening, but not related to that effect, and I simply got the wrong data. So I went to TK, and I've seen a device powered from one single impulse, 1 second impulse for 30 minutes, running without any battery. Let me drop. and the device was not connected to any wires. The only wire that was connected was a ground wire, which is normal. Then when we've been doing a first experiment in Lithuania, and I was in here, and Arunas was in England, and Aidas was in Lithuania, when we started the experiment, nothing was working at that time. We didn't even know that we don't get any effects. We were just talking. So I said, that was after me coming back from TK, and I said, listen, add another spark up. I know that he used two spark ups. And put that spark up in series with the light bulb. Aruna said, you know what, put the diode in series with secondary, that would be the pickup coil, and put a capacitor across. And all of a sudden he said 60 watts light bulb is full brightness. Then he switched to 150 watts, and then he switched to 600 watts, full brightness, 3 watts in input. So one of the key moments in his Avramenkov work, Avramenkov work is two diodes, one in reverse and a capacitor across. That's where the first spark gap is happening. And then you simply go to the caduceus. The caduceus has a special something in it, and I made a number of recorded materials, not all of them published. Then let me just. Then you have two ways, because TK simply found that in 1976 by hoax, not a hoax, but by simple accident. He thought it's a hoax. He thought he is fooling himself. He thought that this thing, and he expressed that to me. I thought that I'm simply lying to myself. That's what I'm seeing. That's what he said. That was his word. The first experiment he made was that he show was in 1992, I believe, then 1994, then he was trying in 2000, and then the last one was in 2008. So he had a number of them. He went to Germany. Everywhere he went, everybody wanted to cheat on him. And basically, whatever was promised to him was never held. It looks like somebody was looking carefully what he's doing. And because he gained an incredible name right now, so he cannot simply die, you know. I would say it this way. Today I was approached by a PhD from Japan. And I sent you the last email that I sent you. This material is approved to be published. And this gentleman said that he was working for Tokyo, Japan. The company, the name is, I'm trying to find out, Genepax. Genepax, G-E-N-E-P-A-X, in Japan. These guys were very much popular in 2008 with the technology car on water that's supposed to fly with a high mass production of the vehicles. 1 liter of water is supposed to power for 1 hour the vehicle with the speed of 80 kilometers. The reason that I said it to you guys is because most of the situation when we deal with the technology that may replace the fuel, there's always something that happens. Now, this gentleman said that he wants to make a material available to Japanese, a number of movies with me, and he is very much moved with what's happened in Fukushima, and he sent his wife with his children to United States while he is still working in Japan after that. And he said, now I know, nothing should be hidden, everything should be delivered to the public and to humanity and to Asia.
you're doing some pretty serious construction, and I've seen some of those photographs. And roughly where do you stand? Are you 50% through the construction or 90% and doing testing? Roughly where do you stand now, Wes? Go ahead.
I believe 80%. 80% of the last 20% is Glenn. I didn't really want it to plug in the original power supply that we have had. And I had the original flyback. I don't have it any longer. I damaged it. So I could have started the device, but I didn't want it to damage the standard. Now, the technology is not... If I was talking about the technology, then I have a technology. Nobody knows what's going on, and nobody really will have the access to that. That would be probably the same like with anybody else. I would have problems or be no longer. But there is at least 10,000 people that were notified about the results of our findings, and they also have a whatever comes from others. So it's a pretty much open source project. It's not only me. I believe I went very far, and when I get the transformer from Glenn, I would be able to really put that device to power. Now, all of the information about that device were sent to at least 5,000 people, and to FGX.
Sounds like you're spending quite a bit of time now communicating with people that want the equivalent of a progress report. Is that sort of true?
The first primary reason that I'm doing it is my safety. I mean, imagine a situation in which tomorrow at 12 o'clock all of the gas stations close up. The reason for that is because when we were dealing with the device in Lithuania, we find out that instead of the requirement of the ground wire to the device, we can put this pull of wire at the given length and create some kind of counterpoise or some kind of balance, and the device works as well as it has, it will have a ground wire. That means that the potential of this technology is to be put to the car. Now imagine all of the automobile industry that will collapse because everybody will throw out the gasoline engine and put the electric engine, cheap electric engine, and just the TK device into that. So, you know, that's probably why so many thousands of people in within the group that is interested with that sharing those information between themselves and Treasury.
I have the impression that you do a certain amount of testing almost every single day. Is that true?
That is correct. I believe I dedicate all of my free time, if not all of the time, to that project. And that's why most of the TechNet subject for the past year were dedicated to a problem that I have had on my way to the point where I am right now. That's why I prepared also a question for the TechNet, who have a chance to go to that. And there is a part of the material that is related also to that progress. I had a question to Glenn. When he would possibly find the time to make the transformer for me, I have ordered all the parts, and the parts are supposed to come tomorrow or maybe 2 days from now.
Well, Wesley, if all goes well, hopefully I'll have it for you sometime this week.
Beautiful. Tell me how much. It is only me who feels how important it's that to me. I was raised in a poor family of teachers, and that's what I'm coming from. that's who I am. You know, it's energy or free energy or untapped energy, whatever you call it. In my mind, it exists, it works, and there is no doubt of it, 100%. In others, doesn't matter. Somebody might not believe in it. That's okay. That's fine. You know, I want to deliver it. If it's not going to be me, I believe to the end of this year. Because right now the proof is tremendous. Tremendous. I mean, the group of the people that I know of is probably 30,000 people a day who reads any material that came from me and or who is, you know, somehow involved in that. And to exchange.
Yeah, Glenn, I've seen those schematics of your driver network and your final network of those field effect transistors, enhancement mode, very Stucci looking circuit. When you look at the data sheet on those transistors, boy, they've got hair on their chest. So that is a driver network. Can do almost anything for the primary of the Glenn transformer. And I think I've heard Wes say that he has bought all those parts, and I guess you're in the process of building that particular network. Is that true, Wes? Over to you, K2RIW.
The device by itself is done, is made, is ready. There is nothing to be done with it. As far as the Glenn's design, I'm waiting for the parts. 100% of the parts is purchased in 10 pieces of each one. Now, after the device will be done, then there will be a publishing of all of the results about it, and I have a few friends. They will immediately start to experiment with the same stuff. I mean, Iras and Arunas, definitely they're going to do this. It is not only that one brain is working on it. It's plenty of people that are working on it. And it's not only one concept. Basically, everybody is repeating what we're doing. There is a guy who is Tiger from Kazakhstan. He has already right now 3 kilowatts of power. I was able to get to 1 kilowatt of power. I mean, not me. I have seen 100 watts on my own eyes in Lithuania. I have seen over the internet 600 watts. 1 kilowatt, I was told that was working. And to exist.
I'm looking now at the first document you mailed tonight, and it's entitled, what's the title here?
Subject for the technet.
I see a gas-fired, laser-triggered, spark-gap switch.
Yeah, well, the physics of photoconductive spark-gap switching. The link is available through the official channels. It's approved for the publication. The http://alexandria.true.nl/extra2/2006-11023 PDF. Anyhow, the interesting factor is in that article is that a group of scientists dedicated their own time, but it wasn't really done for the purpose of just their being interested with it. That was their job, to get into the range of femtoseconds of the high pulse, 4.5 kilovolts, by injecting into the spark gap laser. Let me stop. I was interested because we utilize spark gaps in the application. TK was using 2 spark gaps, so I'm using 2 spark gaps. What they claim in here is they were playing with a 15 picoseconds 15 picoseconds and 100 picoseconds time frames. I'm going to read what they say is that in the recent letter we reported on experiments designed to combine those two switching regimes. Photoconductive switching of semiconductors and laser triggering of the high voltage spark gap. In these experiments, we use a high intensity femtosecond sapphire laser and a gas filled spark gap. But instead of focusing the laser to the point, we use a cylindrical lens to create a slab of plasma between the electrodes. So basically, the laser was at 90 degrees to the spark gap, shooting at the space between the spark gaps of 1 millimeter. The idea was that if the plasma completely fills the gap, the switch will be closed of the femtosecond time scale. The similar photoconductive switching of the semiconductor switches. At the same time, with plasma at the conductive medium, it will be possible to switch large currents without permanent damage to the switching medium. In those experiments, we were able to switch pulses up to 4.5 kilovolts with the measured rise time and the jitter both limited to the time resolution of measurement equipment, 100 picoseconds and 15 picoseconds respectively. So there was a rise time was 100 picoseconds and jitter was 15 picoseconds. But they were also later on, they say, playing with the femtosecond laser beam. So interesting factor in here was, for me, that they were using a coaxial line at 55 ohms of the impedance, and if the spark gap was acting as a perfect switch, that the zero resistance was when it was closed, and the impedance matched to the transmission lines, the signal of the scope was a square pulse at the same time at the other side of the spark gap. That's what I'm trying to get. I'm trying to get the most square signal after the spark gap. And they also were later on in that material talking about the geometry of the electrodes. So when you go to it's a number of articles in here. Feasibility study of the high voltage in plasma diagnostics. Now interferometer. They went to trying to find that page right now. It's a very long article. In one of the pages, they have a analysis of the perfect spark gap and geometry. I relate that to the Army articles that I was reading about, and the number of spark gaps that I have collected, probably 20 of them, of different kinds from the radars. I have seen that some of them were kind of conical but with the cut end at the end, and some of them were sharp. Now, what I find out is that in my particular situation, the sharp end works perfectly. At page 87, you see something that I don't really fully understand, but it looks like they created a channel. Page 87, spark gap optimization according to the literature. They have two electrodes, sharp, conical, and then they have a kind of channel that is conical where the plasma is somehow trapped in between. That's what I would like to give to your attention eventually. Enter XGM.
Yeah, I'm on page 87 right now. I see that picture of that two sharp center conductors. Looks like there's a small gap between them, and the outer conductor also is similarly formed. And I'm getting the impression that the laser-fired spark gap is done in order to get a very precise timing and a very short rise time. And I guess right now I didn't know that you needed that kind of precision and that kind of fast rise time for the experiment you're doing. I thought the TK spark gaps were a little bit more ordinary, not these exotic ones with very fancy triggering. Are you intending to use fancy triggering of the spark gaps and maybe in a repetitive manner of US K2LIW?
KC2QIQ with a comment on this too.
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
One thing that kind of bothered me about some of these videos and some of the things that, you know, Wesley, you're looking into and how well you know some of these people that you're talking to, some of the technology you're looking at, are you sure that all these people are not necessarily looking into just free energy? They might be looking into some other things, and they might not be as good of people as you think they are. Just something for a little food for thought there, Wesley. KC2QIQ.
I think you ought to give us a couple more words, Glenn. There's a couple of ambiguities in what you just said. Try rewording it and ask the question one more time.
It just seems like with some of the evaluations of looking into spark gaps and possibly, you know, things like this are being viewed in Turkey and a couple of other things, you know, where this stuff is being used. You know, spark gaps can be used for a lot of different things. One of my concerns is that, you know, it could be used for triggers. It's not necessarily all such a good thing. Maybe it's not all about free energy, Wesley. KC2QIQ.
I think I know the kind of trigger you're talking about, and that requires extremely precise timing. So you're saying that that might be one of the applications of these possible. Over to you, Wes.
Well, I'm not going to go deep into that. I've got a paper from a scientist from Germany who contacted me, and he said that Caduceus is a guided weapon, Caduceus coil. And I'm not in this area. This is not me, and this I'm perfectly peaceful. Now, I have met a number of people. When I spoke to TK, yes, at first he wanted to make money on it. The major problem on his part was that once the first device is released, everybody knows the secret. And he doesn't have a patent for it. He filed in 2008 for a patent. So now he's supposed to get the denial. So I told him, listen, how many times did you try and you didn't get the money? The only way for you to get the money is just when you release it to the public, 100 people repeat that around the world, and that would be a pressure on the patent office in Turkey when you file for international patent application to give you the patent. The next week is 10,000 people. The next week we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who made that happen. Now, what you're going to do is just wait till you get a patent. And then he asked me, so how much money should I ask for when I get a patent? I said, $1 a year from each citizen of the United States and to Exia.
That would be nice money. Glenn, would you be willing to pay $1 a year for power? I think I would.
You pay already a lot more than that, Dick.
Really? I don't. Well, why do you pay them, Glenn? I'm having some fun with you.
I start to share that idea. And actually, I pushed most of the guys who were having a significant experience in the area of research, some results, just to go open public. So everything started to work rapidly and be like an avalanche since September of last year. There was never so much progress. So yeah, we'll see if we would be able to get to this year. That's fine. If not, guys, nothing is gonna happen. Wesley is going to be in his dream, and you're going to be paying $600 approximately for all of the energy a month that you're using, including gas, for your cars. And to Exxon.
So you're about to assemble all the parts for that latest schematic that Glenn produced for that square wave generator? Is that approximately what's happening next, Glenn? Wes?
That is correct. The reason that I'm going with that, not going with the ordinary spark gobs or whatsoever, is I had a certain experience in Lithuania. I had one of the spark gobs from the radar with me, and we disconnect the spark gob that he had, and we connect this one. Instead of the heavy cracking noise that we have had, we didn't have any sound at all. Complete silence. It was working like a charm, and we had immediate results. Most of the stuff on my all of the stuff was recorded, so there is a proof of that. And even though that this spark up was not made for the high power supposed to burn up, nothing happened to it. It was like a new one. It was handling approximately 15 to 20,000 volts, the first one. The second one, I had another one, which was conical but cut at the end. That one didn't work. Or we just didn't adjust the proper voltage. Now, we estimated that we're dealing with 90,000 volts at the pickup coil. But for sure, we don't know what was the voltage. Yes, I need to be done, and then I'm going to try to understand. TK probably till today do not understand why it works. He knows that it works. He knows how to do it, but he doesn't understand the theory on it. That's why I was dealing with the Yoke from the OCTV. That gave me, and the number of videos that I have made, that gave me at least understanding that has nothing to do with decay, but it is based on nuclear magnetic resonance, and it's not only one way to do it. Once you find the mechanism, you would be able to do it in many other ways. One of the last devices that TK has made was hydroelectric. Hydroelectric device that was producing around 10 kilowatts of power, and he presented that in Germany. I did not understand that till probably 3 days ago, when I found out that the spark could be actually between an electrode and oil, a regular oil. So it's sparking to the oil. I start to understand that because there was another video that I didn't put in here where a guy was playing with an oil and a spark up. And he, yes, I agree with his statement. That's how the hydroelectric, I don't know why he called it hydroelectric, because the water was with the oil was with the water. But hydroelectric generator of TK works. And to Exxon.
When you put a spark gap under oil, I presume the breakdown voltage goes much higher. Therefore, the energy across the spark can be greater before you get erosion of the electrodes. Is that one of the potential benefits, Wes? Go ahead.
This is what I believe is happening. So I know right now at least three ways of getting the right result. What I want to find out is the mechanism that is driving that. And with the help of Glenn, Dick, John, and a few gentlemen that are progressing, we would be able to do it. What I know is a Tiger went up resources, so he's right now, at this very moment, sharing all of the information to others, and he has already 3 kilowatts of power. So, we'll see how soon we would be able to replicate that. At first, I have to be prepared to the point in which I would be able to go further and to XGS.
My first guess is you got to be careful what kind of oil you use. Either silicon or mineral oil, I think, can take the temperature without changing composition. A hydrocarbon oil, an oil-based, you know, a petroleum-based oil, I think is going to eventually turn into sludge. So I think that oil has got to be carefully chosen. Over to you.
That is right. When you don't want that oil to change to sludge, you're going to have a pump and constantly flowing oil. That's what would prevent that would happen. Indeed, this experiment with the gentleman from Russia was doing, within approximately 5 minutes, he changed an oil to the sludge and to XGS.
Do you have an understanding as to why he used oil on the spark gap as opposed to air?
Well, there was a number of videos made by TK with his hydroelectric device, and some of the people, they are pretty much knowledgeable with the chemistry, or chemists, or scientists with the chemists, were sharing the information. This guy simply went with this route. So I would say I don't understand fully, but I understand that there are some people good in one thing. Like, let's say you are good in antenna, and you can put your part of your share to the general knowledge. That's what everybody is doing. And there is the one guy who makes the experiment, and to XGS.
So I think we're saying that we're having a little bit of trouble understanding what's taking place on page 87, is it? Yeah, I think it's page 87.
They have a problem. Why did they? Because in here I don't see the presence of the laser. I'm not really trying to employ the laser. What I'm trying to do is create a situation in which I will have a control over the spark and to precise timing. Based on the text in here, they were able to achieve a perfectly square signal over the spark and to XGS.
Yeah, on page 88, he shows the difference between a biconical gap and a non-tapered gap. Non-tapered gap. The non-tapered gap has a purer-looking rice form on page 88. That looks more desirable, I think.
Non-tapered gap would be a straight cut cylinder?
I haven't read enough, but that's what it sounds like.
There is a catch in here. When they stay in here and there is 100 picoseconds with the voltage, normalized output voltage of 0.7 volts, that should be times 1,000, I believe. The non-tapered gap requires much higher voltage.
I accept that. But can't you overcome that by changing the gap, the width of the gap, in order to make it break down at the voltage you care about?
I believe I have right now, after 4 days of heavily hunting for all of the available military spark gaps, all of the possible spark gaps ever made. That's what I believe. I have a different different electrodes inside. I have a gaps regulations in it. I have a high vacuum. When Glenn would be able to give me the last part, I'm going to build the circuit.